Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Bonulli. We have a very special group and discussion today. Michael Every, Art Berman, and Ira Harris. We're going to do a roundtable discussion on geopolitics, its effects on the economy and the financial markets, and where the markets meet statecraft, a big word that we can get into. Today is Thursday, December 12th in the Western Hemisphere, Friday, December 13th in the Eastern Hemisphere. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Good to be here too.
Yes, it's a great honor. So,
yeah, and just a quick background: Ira's past hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, equities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and his stint also most recently. Michael is global strategist at Rabobank Singapore, where he analyzes major developments and key thematic trends. His research is frequently quoted in financial media. He's a regular conference keynote speaker. He joined Rabobank back in 2013. He's been in the research field for almost 25 years in many different locations. And Art has 40 years of experience as a petroleum geologist. His work focuses on unfiltered data-backed information, takes on the energy and its colossal role in the world's economic pulse. So was thinking maybe we begin with your report recently, Michael, on a shift to economic statecraft, if you wanted to elaborate on that.
Sure. First of all, it's a great pleasure to be here with all of you. Ira, we've done this podcast a couple of times together. Art, you know, we've been conversing for a while. As I said, it's lovely to have this conversation. And to viewers, welcome to the world's least entertaining version of old Jews telling jokes. But let's get down to the serious stuff.
I was kind of thinking of Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield, Two Jews Blues, but we could go there.
Well, yeah, let's see what a Balagan we can make.
I'm older
let's
than
see
you
what
guys.
A Balagan we can make together. So the report that I put out at Rabo just after Trump was reelected was basically making a very simple point, which is now picking up a lot of currency in general commentary, which is that we are going to see under this next Trump administration a decided shift or a further shift away from economic policy, which is how most economists and market analysts are used to analyzing individual decisions that are taken in a more technocratic fashion, towards economic statecraft. And the key difference between the two is economic policy is you're using all the kind of policy toolkit that we already understand to try and achieve a domestic economic, sometimes political, but usually economic aim, like inflation at 2%, a budget deficit at a certain level, you know, a slightly better or worse performance from a given industry sector, et cetera, et cetera. When you're talking economic statecraft, you're using the same toolkit in a very different way sometimes, in an integrated fashion, as part of a grand strategy. You need a vision for that, with a foreign policy or national security goal. And those sound similar, but they are very, very different in how they're applied. So when you have the toolkit, you can start off with, let's say, trade. That's a very obvious one, which is going to be in all the headlines. Obviously, Trump's already talking tariffs and free trade agreements, alternatively, with some, potentially. Now, every single traditional economist who doesn't understand economic statecraft is pulling out their hair again at the thought of there being tariffs, because tariffs are economically inefficient, quote unquote. They create inflation, quote unquote. You know, they're bad, quote unquote. Well, they're a key tool of economic statecraft, and we can get into the long grass of that later. They're going to be around for a very long time, and I think they'll be used not only by Trump, but whoever comes next, because Biden used them too. But you're going to see an expansion of the toolkit within trade. You're going to see an expansion of the toolkit within capital markets as well, for example, whether it's foreign aid, whether it's official loans, whether it's capital controls, whether it's primary or secondary sanctions. All of these are going to be used in different ways. And then you're going to see it start moving into areas that we never think it belongs, but it does. Fiscal policy, obviously, is economic statecraft. Where are you spending your money? Where are you not spending your money? How large and what tricks can you use to expand your fiscal deficit in an emergency? How can you make my life more difficult for others in the same way? And monetary policy, now the Fed, goodness me, we shouldn't ever think that monetary policy can be political. You know, sharp inhale. But at the same time, it can be geopolitical. Where you set interest rates can have a very large impact on what the global financial architecture looks like. And then, of course, and we have, you know, one of the world's leading experts with us here today, I'm delighted to say, we get to areas like infrastructure, food, and energy. And the intersection of how all these play together is going to have a absolutely tectonic effect on markets, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. And recently also, Art, you've written on statecraft as well from the energy angle. Could you elaborate on your recent blog posting?
Certainly, and I want to give Michael credit. He was the one that educated me on the proper use of statecraft as a vocabulary word, and I got a lot of inspiration in terms of how to pull my thoughts, my previous work together around that concept. And so there's a lot about energy that most people don't think about, and I don't really expect them to think about. It's interesting that Henry Kissinger infamously once said that he was confused by all these barrels of oil and they might as well be filled with Coca-Cola. He changed that position fairly quickly and within a few years was saying that with oil you rule nations, with food you control the people in those nations. And so when I look at present economic policy, economic statecraft, tariffs, current history, and then I go back and look at the progression, the evolution of power over the last, however long you want to go, but certainly since the beginning of the 20th century, I see oil as one of the leading, if not the primary theme. And so just to bring the viewers up to date, it's very clear to me, and I'm not the first one to say this by any means, anyone who hasn't read Daniel Yergin's The Prize, it's a very readable book. It's 30 years old at this point, and it's every bit as relevant as it was when it was published. World Wars I and II were won and lost based on the supply of gasoline. Basically, the German army in 1918 literally ran out of gas at the Somme. They ran out, and that was the end of the war. Hitler's army, their final push at the so-called Battle of the Bulge, what that battle was all about is that's where Eisenhower had all the gasoline depots. It was what some people called the biggest gasoline station in the world. And had Germany won the Battle of the Bulge, they probably could have continued the war for some time. They lost, and that was the end of the war. Most people don't know these things and have great arguments and discussions about strategy and all sorts of other things, which are absolutely important, if not critical. But at the end of the proverbial day, the United States supplied at least 70% of all the fuel for the two world wars. And the fact that the United States chose not to get involved in the First World War until it was almost over was because we were making a ton of money selling not only oil, but all sorts of other supplies, not to mention all the gold from Britain and France were flowing into the United States, and in the 1920s, there were more transactions in dollars than in pounds sterling, which is another thing that most people don't understand, and it was our control, the United States control of oil, that allowed all of that to happen. So if you want to understand what is key to statecraft, you better understand oil, because so much of what I see, and I'm eager to hear Michael's thoughts on this, so much of what goes on in today's political arena is still mired in 19th and 20th century concepts of basically zero-sum gain kinds of territorial and mercantile considerations. And so even people who along the way, and by the way, Hitler was 100% clear on the need for oil, so was Kaiser Wilhelm. But then again, the Renaissance popes were 100% clear they had to clean up the church, and they didn't for seven papacies. So, that's another discussion we can have all together. But, it seems crazy to me that Trump is talking about putting tariffs on renewable energy from China when we're sending China almost 500,000 barrels of crude oil and petroleum products a day to power their military. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should embargo them. I'm just saying that doesn't seem like a very smart thing to do if you consider China your number one adversary. And by the way, when Trump talks about maximum pressure on Iranian and Russian oil, I mean, the U.S. Navy could do that. We could cut, if we wanted to, or we could threaten to cut China's oil supply by 5 million barrels a day in a matter of almost no time at all. And China knows that. Okay, now that's power. That's a lot of power, and that's power that speaks to China's heartbeat, its hemoglobin, and it knows that. I'll leave it there.
Interesting. And Ira, do you see this shift also to economic statecraft? What are your thoughts?
Well, to me, this is what I've studied my whole life, so it makes certain eminent sense, and I'll tie this all together because my father, may rest in peace, flew the bombing runs on Pulaski oil fields in 1943 to ensure that the German war machine wasn't going to have Romanian oil. Interesting that he came from Romania, but he was a navigator, flew out of Italy. So I grew up on those stories, and the only reason I'm here is because they were at the front of the movement, because more planes, 60% of those bombers were lost because of the heat that came up from the oil fields, which destroyed a lot of the bombers because they had to come in low to ensure. The fact that my dad was a navigator, I grew up listening to those stories, so I'm kind of, it brings everything full circle. And these are things that don't change. I mean, if you go back to the 70s when I was in school and really studying currencies and bond markets, so much, the third world debt problem was a problem of oil. Because once OPEC raises oil, the cost to the developing world, what we called the third world at that time, or the LDCs, the less developed countries, their import costs went up dramatically. And you learn the lesson that the only way that they can afford it is that the OPEC nations were recycling petrodollars, which you get the petrodollar standard, which Mike has talked about, and certainly Zoltan Pozsar and others, but you get into that realm because who needs to borrow that kind of money as the OPEC nations were recycling their money through US banks, but it was countries who were in trouble. And what were they in trouble for? Paying those huge import bills for the oil. So it's always there. And I know I read Art's pieces, and this isn't a discussion about alternative energy, because we could argue that goes nowhere. We have to deal with what it is. And if the market deems that alternative energy is now the more efficient form, the market will shift dramatically, unless ridiculously subsidized, but that's a whole different discussion. But energy is what runs this world. to be a pun, it fuels economic development. And as long as natural gas and crude oil, and now rightfully so, nuclear is back into the discussion, which it needs to be, because as you know, I think Doomberg, who really does a lot of good work, and certainly Goering and Rosenzweig, who talk about the return on energy investments, there's nothing as efficient as nuclear energy. And if you're going to get through these next 25 or 30 years through the transition, you're going to have to do this and do it right, because otherwise the global south, as we now call that part of the world, well, they'll burn coal. And you can't blame them for burning coal, because why should they stifle their development? They're going to burn the cheapest energy that they can. And because the world is the earth is a closed system, it gravitates back to you. So all these conversations are mandatory and necessary. And if we can do better through carbon sequestration and other things, great. But there is a cost borne to it. And how we bear it is really what we're all sitting here discussing, and how it goes and how it gets financed. You know, I laugh, you know, when people talk about reparations in the United States, I said, that's not where I would start. If you want to do it with the Western nations, so-called Western nations, the colonial powers of from 15, 16, 17, 18, well, you want to pay reparations, pay them to the nations that you absolutely subdued. And that's what China's saying. You know, China's making huge inroads into the global South, because that's what they're saying. You want to go green? Well, who's going to pay for it? It's expensive technology. And then that becomes, as Mike would certainly say, this is part of the statecraft that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, some good points. And Michael, following up from Art's observations, can you apply your paradigm vision of shift to economic statecraft to the energy, oil and gas sector?
Well, I'm no expert in that area. I want to make that abundantly clear. I thought Art's paper was brilliant, and I think everyone should read it. In fact, I'm hoping in the comments we can put a link to his paper and to mine and to all relevant material, so that viewers can really be in the loop on this discussion, because I think they should be. I think the key point really is that everything that Ira and Art said is correct, but we won't have the answer until we start to understand what the US's grand strategy is. Now, I don't want to be normative and say what the US's grand strategy should be. I'm not even American, as you can clearly hear. But I think what we have to try and do is predict what we think it will be, because if we're talking about financial markets, what will be is the nearest we're ever going to get. And I think when you have people who understand realpolitik and who do understand economic statecraft to some degree, moving closer to the levers of power rather than people who, just as I said, focusing on economic policy, they will start looking at the kind of thoughts that Art's putting forward. They will start to understand this. So then when you start refining that strategy, you have to start thinking, okay, we understand this standoff with China, or this Cold War, this decoupling with China. We understand that there's a urgent need for the US to reduce its trade deficit, not just with China, but with the rest of the world, but primarily with China, to reindustrialize as much as possible, to onshore or friendshore or nearshore as much as possible, to ensure that the Pentagon's military industrial supply chains are, you know, sustainable in the broadest sense of the term. And I don't just mean green. I mean, are they reliable? And the US socioeconomic polarization doesn't get any worse, which again is going to require more reindustrialization of sorts, rather than saying learn to code and go and live on the East Coast or West Coast. And by the way, learning to code won't do it now, because AI will replace those jobs too. So what is everyone going to do? We can't all be, we can't all be podcasters or social media influencers. That's not a long-term viable economy. So what's the actual strategy in terms of the US retaining its role globally, retaining its stability domestically, and then where does energy fit into that? And I think, again, Art raised some brilliant points that there is obviously going to be a large role for green technology. There has to be. Does it make sense to tariff that so that you develop your own alternative supply chain if it's going to be worse technology and more expensive vis-a-vis China? Because at the moment, that appears to be what it would risk being. So you gain jobs, but effectively you become the USSR within the past Cold War paradigm, in that you've got the crappier, more expensive product that people don't really want, and everyone's desperate to have a suitcase full of blue jeans and Coca-Cola, except we're talking EVs and Chinese products here, which are harder to fit in a suitcase. But I genuinely think that, again, I keep deferring to Art because he's the expert here, the US does still have a lot of fossil fuels, and obviously how it uses them and the price point matters. Canada has, to a degree, Mexico has some, and the USMCA, I think, geopolitically has to be seen as one block. I mean, you've seen with Trump's threat of tariffs, he regards Canada and Mexico as the nearer broad. I wouldn't be surprised to see an extension of the Monroe Doctrine coming back and looking at Latin America, maybe even at Venezuela. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. And then, of course, and very, very topical as we're talking here, what does that mean for the Middle East? Because I think if the US can start getting the fossil fuel action back in focus in the Western Hemisphere, so North America and Latin America, and then starts to refocus on the Middle East again in one way or another, that doesn't really leave China a great deal of options. If it realizes, again, as Art said, that the military machine of the world will not run on green energy. And I just want to finish my point there on one little hilarious and rather tragicomic note, that the British, who of course were the past masters of economic statecraft and grand strategy, mm-hmm. have shriveled away, and I'm a Brit, as you can hear, to such an extent that we recently had the new foreign minister, emphasizing that he's all in favor of pushing ahead with the green transition for the British armed forces. So we're going to hopefully have electric aircraft carriers and electric tanks and electric F-35s. I know, I can see the wincing faces. I mean, there's just no logic to this whatsoever. But that's just an indication that the British military muscle, such as it is going to atrophy even further, even faster. So having planted those seeds, I'm happy to pass the ball back to Art and see what you think in that regard.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Michael. I don't know where to start here exactly. First of all, let me disrupt everything for a moment and say that the energy transition is a fantasy. It's not real, and it won't happen. There's never been an energy transition in the history of humankind. All we do is add new energy on top of the old. We're using just as much biomass today as we used in 1800. We're using more coal today than we used in 1800. So the energy, there is no energy transition. All we're doing is adding new energy on top of the old. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, if you look at the countries that are the most committed to renewables, their commitment is inversely proportional to their reserves of crude oil. And so when people say, oh, you know, look how great China's doing, I mean, you know, we should be doing, whoever we are, you know, we should have a master strategy like they do. Well, of course they're into it because they don't have any oil. Europe is hugely committed to renewable energy because they don't have any oil. Okay, that's a weakness. That's not a strength. And again, I just, so anybody who doesn't know my work, I am as committed as anybody to the ecosphere and a more balanced way that humans need to learn to live within that system. We're way out of control. Our human growth needs to be addressed. It won't, but you know, enough said there. The total, so to bring it together, the very first significant increase in energy that the world has seen in 50 years is upon us now in the area of electric demand from data centers and AI. Okay, I think most people listening to this know that. Okay, guess who didn't get a call? Wind and solar. They didn't even get a casting call. Why? Because it's no good. It's just no good for that purpose. Ira mentioned renewables. I'm sorry, nuclear. Nuclear is a bridge to nowhere, in my opinion. It's part of the future. It's part of the present. It's not going away. I'm absolutely nothing I say here, by the way, and I'm sure this is true for everyone else. It's not prejudicial, and it's certainly not political. It's just based on the data as I see it. Nuclear cannot be scaled fast enough to move any needle in any direction between now and 2050 or 2060 or 2070. The time to have done that was 50 years ago. We're way too late, and despite all the, you know, the hype, it's just it's not a solution to much of anything. And if it is a solution, like renewables, it's only good for electric power. And electric power is 20% of the world's energy consumption. So all of this, you know, all of the discussion that so consumes the public and the press is trivial. I mean, when you get right down to it. And again, I'm not in any way saying, oh, we should go with fossil fuels, you know, they're better and forget about. All I'm saying is that renewables are part of the future. Nuclear is part of the future. It's not a big part of the future, despite what other people think. And more important to this conversation, the countries that are big into it are weak. And the countries that are not potentially are strong. And that should be the point, one of the points of statecraft.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Syrah, and also how
again, this, so we'll bring it full circle. And I love this discussion. And I, again, and Art makes it clear, and Michael makes it clear, this, there's nothing partisan, there's no political here, because I don't have time for that nonsense. If I get involved in that, you know, I'm everything we discuss is my ability to turn it into a profitable investment or trade. And a lot of times, mostly trades, but certainly in the way that I trade equities, that's more investable. So I'm looking for that. And I can't deal in rainbows and unicorns. And, you know, if it can't sustain a baseload, which is what Art's talking about, it really has no utility value. For you can't drive these AI centers without insured baseload. And wind and solar, battery technology has not caught up to everybody's fantasy, so that's not taking place. But from the statecraft, now you're talking about this energy has to flow around the world. And you can live in fantasy lands all you want, but you know, we're involved in a war in Ukraine, and we're involved more, but you can't fault the Russians. And I know Art, I read your piece, and it irritates me to even cite him, but he's right, John Mearsheimer. And I said, because I'm not a fan for many reasons. In fact, he's teaching a class at Oakton Community College on top of his University of Chicago, which was two miles away from where I raised my kids. So I've read a lot of Mearsheimer, but not a Mearsheimer fan, but it does prove right. And you have to then answer things in different ways. It's like when you talk about, if we talk about China, we're talking about the Straits of Malacca, right? We know how much flows through there. It's the same reason that Putin grabbed back Crimea, because Crimea through Sevastopol protects Russian through the Dardanelles. I mean, that's going back to, should we go to Peter the Great? I mean, that's just a long held, and when Khrushchev gave it back to the Ukraine, I would say, are you nuts? Because we have to ensure everything that goes through the Dardanelles. And we need a presence there. It's the same reason, you know, and then I look at people, I go, it's the same reason that we sustain Guantanamo. Do you not think about why do we have a naval base on Cuba? I know we had a 100-year lease agreement for whatever the number was, ridiculous. But why do we have a naval base in Guantanamo? It's statecraft. And that's to ensure that nobody closes off the Gulf of Mexico, where more energy and food, which comes down the center of the United States through the Mississippi River, through the port of New Orleans, and we have Houston. There's so much that flows out of there. Guantanamo protects the free flow of all that going back to what both Art and Michael talk about, the statecraft with what has to come out of there. You're not building oil pipelines from the United States to Europe. That's not going to happen. So it's going to flow by ship. And therefore, you protect those sea lanes. I mean, that's been going on. And that's part of how we have to negotiate the world. And you look at the Ukraine and you can, you know, should it? I go, a lot of people have died, but what are we really talking about here? And the Russians are not going to give back Crimea. There's no how, no way, especially because they just underwent how to deal with the sanctioning. And we're not, we haven't even talked about that. And do sanctions work? I don't think they've ever worked. Cuba's been sanctioned since 1959, and we haven't overturned the Castro regime since 59. And I'm not arguing, there's no qualitative discussion there, because I can't, but you go to other places, and the sanctions led to war in Asia with Japan. So that is not, you really want to sustain the flow of that type of commercial. And that's what the Chinese are trying to do. You can tell them, you can complain all you want about the size of the Chinese Navy. It's purposeful. And it's, the Chinese are totally dependent. They're probably the most, as Art talks about, they're more dependent upon this to sustain themselves. You know, it's not like China is sitting on a bed of petroleum. It's not. You know, Xinjiang is very rich in a lot of minerals, but oil is not one of them. So, and they've got a billion two people. And then you have India. So India benefits to it too, but they don't have to send their oil unless it's coming out of Indonesia through the shortest route. But but they're subject to the Houthis, right? And interestingly, and I think it was Art who talked about it, because, you know, the Biden administration not calling the Chinese on the carpet because they have that, the only naval port they have for it is Djibouti. Well, right. Take a map out and look at Djibouti. Gee, they could have shut down the Houthis whenever they wanted to. In fact, had there been an international effort to Michael statecraft, that's exactly what would have been done. And everybody's decrying this, that, and the other. Well, the Horn of Africa is in the throes of more violent civil wars than anywhere else. I mean, this has been going on for years. And the Chinese have a definitive placer, and why? Because it protects that oil coming out. So it's everything.
I have to just jump in for a second if I can there, because this is a point I wanted to raise, and that's the perfect segue to it. If you don't mind, Ira. Obviously, a lot of us get our news from Twitter now, or X, because it's faster than traditional media. Let's not get into the whole kind of culture war or where we should or shouldn't get our news flow. But I did see this week when I was presenting at a conference in India, that there was word going around that one of the first things that Trump is going to do amongst the slew of statecraft changes that he's going to introduce is to recognize Somaliland. Because Somaliland is a breakaway state, unrecognized from Somalia, which is itself on the Horn of Africa, and pretty much a failed state in most respects. To say that stirs a hornet's nest is an understatement in terms of the politics with Egypt, Somalia, Ethiopia, all kind of forces can get involved there. But if that were to occur, you've got a US friendly, or it will be US friendly, or a US protector effectively, all the way along the stretch of the Horn of Africa. And at the same time as that's going on, of course, you've got all the dynamics going on in the Middle East where the Syrian government has collapsed. Syria itself is now being carved up into mini statelets. Turkey has, of course, grabbed territory via Islamists in the Northeast, and it's already taken the oil from that area there. So there's energy, to your point, Art. And I'm sure that is absolutely what's driving them, as well as, you know, worries about Kurdish successionism.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole Middle Eastern game starts all over again. Any tentative thoughts that we were moving towards stability are thrown up in the air. We don't know exactly where the pieces are going to come down. But I think the most important takeaway from that is that despite, and excuse my French, god awful non-economic statecraft under the Biden White House, where I mean, just incredible, staggering incompetence in terms of what's been allowed to develop in the Middle East, if nowhere else. Trump comes into office And Napoleon always said, give me lucky generals. Well, Trump is a lucky general. He walks in, all the pieces are up in the air. And what people have been talking about just months ago, which is you're going to have a reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. China is going to be the new granddaddy along with Russia in the Middle East. All of these dollar-pegged currency oil producers are going to be shifting to some new BRICS currency, this fantasy object that's going to appear at some point. All of them are going to be sending their oil back to China, and the US is going to be pushed out of the region. Where's Russia now? Well, they've probably just lost their air base in Syria and their one warm water port, which also means they can't reach into Africa so easily. Turkey is now, of course, on the other side of the balance sheet from them geopolitically, and that brings the Dardanelles into play again alongside Ukraine. Although where Turkey sits, of course, is a big question. Syria's just dissolved. If you're Saudi Arabia, are you seriously thinking about looking at Iran now, which has just seen all of its concentric circles of proxies collapse one after the other? Only the Houthis are left. And I'm sure at some point soon, serious firepower will be turned in their direction to explain to them, you know, what happens if they keep doing what they're doing. So all that's happening. And at the same time, and this is the last point I'll make, is that if you look at some of the other figures who are being talked about as having key roles in the upcoming Trump administration, they are deadly serious about America going back to sea again, because the U.S. Navy is rusting. It's a vast force built at the height of the Cold War, which is actually getting smaller every year because you can't replace ships because your industrial supply chains are so monopolized and inefficient that you build one ship for every three you have to retire or something like that. You can't keep scrapping them faster than you're building them and retain primacy. That's obvious. So the industrial supply chain has to change. The Navy is going to have to come back, and it's going to have to be more of a British-style policy. So I don't expect to see American navies or the Navy floating around the world seas, keeping it open for everyone, which is what America has been doing, A, post-World War II, and B, very much post-Cold War. You know, we're there to fight pirates. We keep everything open and free, so everyone else can shift goods cost-free or, you know, trouble-free from A to B and benefit from this global network. No, it's going to start to be, are you in my gang or are you not? Are you helping on the energy front, on the trade front, on the industrial front, or are you not? Because if not, well, you know, you go and worry about the Houthis or the equivalent that we will arm ourselves yourself, because, you know, we're only going to be here for people who pay taxes to America because it costs money to run a Navy. So this is all part of the shift I expect to see. And if you're a European economy which thinks you can just export from your country to everyone else around the world, and the world is a lovely map you have up on your wall behind you, and it's a flat world, like, you know, Thomas Friedman was talking about, where you are going to be flattened, because that's economic policy, not economic statecraft, and it's not going to lead you anywhere good.
Hear, hear. And our we admire Alfred Thayer Mahan and what you know, he was a naval theorist. I help me out, Michael. This was back in the 1880s or 90s or something. And what's missed is that what made American power what it is was not copying the British model of naval dominance, but building naval vessels powered with petroleum. And of course, Churchill recognized this, and he did everything in his power to get the British Navy converted from coal into petroleum. In fact, he convinced, help me out here again, I think it was Prime Minister Asquith in 1914 or something like that, the British government took a controlling interest in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, specifically for that purpose. That's not something that, you know, that the Crown ordinarily does. And so, but to your point about the flat world and also Ira, the Strait of Malacca, I'll come back to the flat world. Whenever there's a problem in the Middle East, everybody says, oh my God, the Strait of Hormuz, you know, maybe it's going to get closed, maybe it's not. For those who don't know, the Strait of Hormuz is the narrows that controls the oil outflow from the Persian Gulf. And it's massive, it's monstrous, but it's much less, or 4 million barrels a day less than the Strait of Malacca, which runs along the coast of Indonesia. And guess where China gets all of its oil from? So there's something like, you know, 18 million barrels of oil and petroleum products that go through the Strait of Malacca and something, you know, like 15 or 16 through Hormuz. Why is China aggressive in the South China Sea? Real simple, guys. That's their lifeblood right there. And China, I think I mentioned in my article, I mean, China's, I don't know if they're scared, but they're always concerned about the U.S. Navy cutting off their supply of oil at Malacca, which, you know, would be, I don't know that we would do that. But back to Michael's point, absolutely, the Navy is the key. And where the U.S. got completely off track was when it started putting ground troops into all sorts of god-awful places, starting with Vietnam and, oh my God, Korea. And I mean, all of these rinky-dink kind of places. I mean, the communists were just absolutely having a field day with the United States, getting us to expend vast amounts of treasure on, you know, 10th-rate kind of countries on this preposterous domino theory. And, you know, I'm sure Ira has some thoughts there, but, you know, go back to a guy like Melvin Loeffler, you know, and I mean, his point, I think 20 years ago, was the whole Cold War strategy was fallacious, that Russia probably never had the kind of aggressive, not intent, but capability that we impugn to them. And what happened in the Cold War is that the U.S. statecraft got distracted from oil, which it had been clearly tracking since before World War I, and all of a sudden we got distracted with things like Europe. And so to your flat earth, or, you know, the Friedman comment, I mean, what America and perhaps Europe don't understand is that Europe has no strategic significance at all at the moment, except as a market, at least from a realpolitik standpoint, for U.S. LNG and crude oil. It has no strategic value. And the Ukraine story with IRA, no, Crimea is not going back, and neither is the Donbas. But I think Russia has re-emphasized Loeffler's point. I mean, Russia is a third-rate military power, and it's probably a fifth-rate economic power. Why are we focused on them? And so, you know, to Trump's point, you know, China's where we ought to be focused. Okay, great. Back to renewables. I say, let them knock themselves out. You guys produce all, you know, use all of your subsidies and everything you want to produce as many solar panels and wind turbines and electric cars as you possibly can. And the reindustrialization that ought to be going on in the United States ought to be around semiconductors and real industries that we exported to the rest of the world during the globalization trend, and I'll leave it there.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Effects on trade, economic sanctions, capital exchange controls. Can you elaborate a bit more in that regard, how the statecraft evolves in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's talk about fiscal policy. Very obviously, fiscal policy is going to have to focus on those areas, because America spends an awful lot of money every year on things that don't really help economic statecraft. And that links in, of course, to monetary policy. You know, where are interest rates going to sit? Because if they're too low, yes, on one hand, that makes financing the government deficit much easier, and the government's going to have to be doing a lot of this spending. But on the other hand, that, because of the way the financial system works, just makes everyone go and speculate on silly assets. So again, that distracts attention away from focusing on the bread and butter of the issue. And this actually brings us back to another point I was making prior to the paper on statecraft, but it was very much thinking along the same lines, which is, if we understand our current American and hence global system, we have one benchmark interest rate, Fed funds, effectively. That goes up or down. The whole world listens and pays attention to every word they say as if they're gods, as Trump was saying. And then everyone around the rest of the world takes that, takes margin, and decides they want to invest it short-term or long-term, wherever they want to, in whichever sector, to try and make a return. That's pretty much the world system, right? It's pretty easy, bullet point. But the idiocy, and it is idiocy, of saying, okay, so we're America, we don't produce enough of X, Y, or Z, which is existential to remain the world's leading power, and we produce far too much of A, B, and C, which is frankly irrelevant, silly stuff. So let's raise interest rates to cut off the silly stuff. Oops, that's blown up the important existential stuff. Okay, fine. Let's cut interest rates really, really low to help stimulate the really existential stuff. Oops, now we've got far too much of the silly stuff. If you were a child, you could understand this is a wrong way to run your political economy. So effectively, what I've been arguing already for a couple of years is that as part of statecraft, you're going to need fiscal and monetary policy to work together in a far more proactive and creative sense, where you actually have looser and tighter policy together at the same time, in a way that traditional economic analysis doesn't fully understand. Now, one tiny example of that, tiny, and I agree with what Art said, because I defer to him on everything energy, but it's a kind of a point that supports what I'm saying while arguing slightly against one of his in the short term. France has just said, for example, they're going to make sure that the nuclear sector within France gets interest-free loans. So there's no cost of interest whatsoever. Now, you can apply exactly the same kind of macroprudential measures, if you will, within America. You can say, right, fine, if you're going to reindustrialize for something that helps the Pentagon, zero cost. Then, of course, you're going to have to start having bureaucrats making sure that people don't just take that and arbitrage it and do something else with it. Because, you know, you need to have guardrails. So I know it gets complicated. There's no ideal system, but that's going to have to be part of it. But there are going to be some opportunities and some fun and crazy ones, because I want to just segue slightly but show how things join up. A friend of mine, Luke Groman, I'm sure many viewers will be familiar with who he is.
Yep.
See the world in very similar terms, even if we disagree on some key conclusions. But, you know, a lot of what he says I agree with completely. He came out with a brilliant point a couple of weeks ago where he said, you know, he said, I think I can see a role for Bitcoin here. Now, I've never been interested in crypto. I've always called it crapto. I thought that what would happen with it would be what the Democrats have tried to do, which is say you can't make your own money because you can't. But, you know, Luke bothered to read one of these long, complex government papers in that area. And normally I do it in statecraft, and he did it there. And I'm glad he did, because he said, look, what they're arguing is, if you manage to make a Bitcoin strategic reserve in the US, let's say you just declare that day one and Bitcoin goes from 100,000 to a million as a result, and therefore all the stable coins, which are the umbilical cord coming out of that, have to rise proportionately too. They have to back all those stable coins one-to-one with T-bills. Now, whether you think this is a silly system or not, and I do, you've suddenly created a demand for trillions of dollars worth of T-bills. Well, who might need a few trillion dollars to try and reindustrialize or to subsidize industrial supply chains? Or to, you know, have extra capital to bribe foreign powers, what you name it. Suddenly, Trump is a lucky general again. He comes into office, and with the stroke of a pen, he might potentially have this enormous windfall. And can Europe do that? No. Can Japan do that? No. Can China do that? Not in the same way. They can do different things. So these are just some of the elements. And of course, it will feed into all the other areas we've already spoken about. But if you understand how this game will be played, just as a punter, your potential profit opportunities are huge. And equally, if you don't understand it, it will be played. You miss out on it completely. But if you think it's business as usual, and you think Bloomberg headlines are going to capture what's going on, and very, very traditional establishment thinking is going to fully grasp the complexity and the interaction of a financial economy where some people get interest-free loans and some people have to pay 7% all of a sudden, and you can't arbitrage between them, and certain sectors are just told, you're stupid and irrelevant, we don't need you, and other things which are stupid and irrelevant are suddenly incredibly important because they provide some kind of money printing effectively to finance the military, Well, yeah, you're going to get flattened once again.
Yeah, and I want to amplify some of those points, because we talk an awful lot, everyone talks a lot about price and cost, but very few people ever talk about value. And so if we take a barrel of oil and we can measure very carefully, you know, how many megajoules or kilocalories or whatever are in a barrel of oil, we know that. I mean, it's a precise kind of thing. And we convert that to human labor. And we end up with 11 years of man work in one barrel of oil. Now, if we discount that back for human productivity, we end up with something like 4.5 years in a barrel of oil. If we take the median income of the United States, which is $80,000, and multiply by 4.5, we get something like $350,000 for a barrel of oil in value. All right. And so there's nothing in the world that compares to that. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not nuclear, not, and the idea that renewables are the cheapest form of energy is complete hogwash. It's like saying you buy a car and your only cost is the cost of the purchase, and that you don't have to buy fuel, you don't have to maintain it, you don't have to license it. It's preposterous. And again, I'm not arguing against renewables, because I think that they are a durable and important part of our future. I'm just trying to, you know, to level some of the nonsense that guides people's decisions or their thinking. And incidentally, there's an awful lot of people who are in positions of economic policy and statecraft that believe this crap. And so how in the world do you expect them to be the masterminds of what we're talking about? And I think all agreeing on, if they don't have the facts straight and they don't understand the value proposition that's involved. And once more, I'm not in any way arguing that we ought to go full tilt toward fossil fuels and screw the environment. And no, not at all. I'm just trying to, you know, to lay it out from a financial and power perspective, which is ultimately the most persuasive thing that goes on in the world, I believe.
Exactly. And I guess from an investor perspective, Ira, what are your thoughts? Like, is the investor today now going to be corralled into investing more locally, more jurisdictionally based on the, you know, the statecraft industrialization and, you know, concerned about geopolitical risks for sending money and funds abroad? Like, what are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I mean, let's go back to what Michael talked about. And, you know, it was interesting last week, Powell gave that interview with Andrew Ross Sorkin, and it was really disheartening because Sorkin actually asked a couple relevant questions. He didn't follow them up, but he did ask relevant questions. He asked Powell about fiscal dominance, and Powell said, "We're nowhere near fiscal dominance." And I wanted to gag on myself because he should have read Charles Calamaris's piece at the St. Louis Fed, written, I think, in May or April of 2023. And fiscal dominance is here. And that's going to affect, again, let's come back to statecraft. It's going to affect, number one, how you do a lot of discretionary spending. We're already there. My friend Kevin McCarthy and I, for 2-3 years, I've talked about it many times in the podcast when I was blogging regularly. I would talk about it. But Kevin McCarthy, not the congressman, but I went to graduate school with him, and he's really an expert on so much of this discussion, and talked about this was for sure 2 years ago, what's going to happen when the interest cost of the debt exceeds the defense budget. Then you get into serious, you want to talk about issues of statecraft? That's issues of statecraft, because now you have to discern how you're going to spend it on green energy. Well, you were But now you have things that get in the way because everybody makes a call on money. These are the important things. And we are at fiscal dominance. Unless the Fed cuts rates, you know, again, we're going to argue about our star and where this goes. So I know we're going to go a little field from art, but this is a very important issue because the cost of money is really what it's all about. If it's not, then let's just go print all the money we can, throw it at the green revolution, throw it at the energy, the fossil fuel patch, throw it at nuclear and the hell and get whatever we can get. Oh, and then by the way, don't forget to build out the grid to sustain a lot of what you want to do. So no, there's a cost to it. And we're at that cost now. And how you're going to negotiate that is really what we're all concerned about, because it's going to eat. Had Kamala, and this is, again, this is nonpartisan. I'm not, because the election results are the election results. I'm not going to beat that's, but had Kamala won, the discussion about what we're going to do with the money and how you're going to is a far different discussion. It's all going to have to be financed. But I will tell you this, and I'm actually anticipating this, how it plays out, I don't know. But having Scott Bessent in that seat gives me a more interested view, because I'm a global macro guy. I'm Scott Bessent, I happen to be in the, I'm very honored to say so, but Steve Drobny wrote that book, Inside the House of Money, back in 2005, in which he interviewed Bessent, Dwight Anderson, Jim Rogers. There was a Ford trader named Ira Harris. I don't know how I got in there, but I'm in there. Jim Leitner, Peter Thiel. I mean, it's, and go think, because now you've got somebody by Scott Bessent, to forget what Trump has to say. How is Bessent going to navigate exactly all the things we're talking about? Because here's somebody who thinks in these terms. Everything that we're talking about here is thinking, we can call it statecraft, we can call it global macro. And it all, energy is what fuels it all, because without it, you're not going anywhere anyway, and the global economy is going to collapse. So let's be honest with that. So now how do we make it fit together? And again, we talk about Luke Grohman, and I'm a big fan of Luke. I don't agree with him a lot, but he always is going to make you think about things. And that Thiebaud piece was an absolute important piece. And now Bessent comes in and he's saddled with this because Janet and Lael have played with this in order to prevent a failed auction. Because as you get to the, and I don't care whether the US, you know, at some point the world's gonna say no. They're gonna say no. And the best thing that could happen, see, I think if Scott Bessent have a failed auction, because then you get to kick everybody in the teeth and go, this is serious, get to work. And we have to figure out how we're going to do, how we're going to finance. Art wants to do this, and we're all for it, and we need it, but you're going to have to pay for it. You're going to have to pay for it. And you got somebody, you know, at your heels called China, who's trying to figure out a way to undermine that financing of it, because they've got their own initiative. And they, oh, by the way, they also happen to own $1 trillion of your T-bills. I'm not a fan. And again, as the world goes chasing energy, I'm not a fan of a strong dollar. I think, and if I'm sitting with Scott Bessent, yes, I'm a fan of a favor of a strong dollar if you earn that strength. But just based on pure interest rate differentials, that's a false bravado. Because I've seen, look at Brazil raised interest rates 100%, 100 basis points last night. And the rate still went and made all-time lows. It came back a little bit, but you're forcing those countries who are trying to defend themselves. They don't want their currencies collapsing against the dollar because their costs rise dramatically. So you've got a world, I know, Mike, I'll stop, but you got a world saddled with you with dollar-denominated debt that has to be financed. Figure out how to pay for it.
Totally. I mean, I'd love to just carry on from there just for a second. When we're in this world of what I've tried to dub grand macro strategy, it's probably too long a title, but that's the kind of That's the title I'm hoping people will think about, because it is grand strategy and it is macro, and it's not just global macro, because that can be kind of traditional ways of looking at the world. It's got to be from this strategic lens. So I'm calling it grand macro strategy. You're going to get some short term tactical windfalls, like, you know, what Luke was describing. I call that the crypto dollar, because you had the petrodollar, you know, where all those earnings had to go straight back into treasuries. Well, now the crypto dollar, great, you inflate that asset bubble, that's going to go straight back into T-bills here. So the crypto dollar may be a short-term thing, but it's not a long-term thing. So part of that grand macro strategy is trying to think, yeah, how does the U.S. sit best here? And I think the historical look back to look forward is more likely the early British Empire, not the late British Empire, which is what the U.S. has been aping recently, where you have investments around the world, but you run a large current account deficit, which is bridged by the earnings that you get from everywhere else and that capital flowing back in. So you're an import-dependent economy. I think they're going to be looking much more at the early British Empire, when it was an industrial powerhouse, where the strength of the currency was due to the fact China-style, they were, you know, the reliable and inevitable physical machine that everyone needed. They were the workshop of the world. So in the interim, ironically, just to go to the interest rate argument, I can see that while in the long run it's a disaster to have a high interest rate because you can't finance your military machine or anything else. I argued that back in 2018. He who borrows cheapest longest tends to win these struggles. And, you know, the Bank of England was set up specifically to allow that to happen vis-a-vis France. I do think in the short run, and the short run could be, you know, all of Trump's term and a bit longer, let's be realistic, the US can use high interest rates and that differential as a weapon. Because, as you said, Brazil raises rates, the currency goes down. We've had the SMB slashing 50 basis points when people didn't expect it in Switzerland. The Europeans have just cut again and say they're going to keep cutting. Everyone else basically is throwing in the towel. At this point, I know the Fed aren't into this grand macro strategy, but they can have a gun put to their head and be told to do it at some point eventually. All they've got to do is, bite the bullet and say, well, we can stay higher than you. And you suck capital out of the rest of the world. And now what you do with that capital, that's a different question. Does it just go into frivolous things or into existential things? Do you channel it back into productive areas to help build that early British Empire kind of industrial muscle? Or do you just say, hey, the S&P is going up, let's all go on holiday to Jamaica and, you know, and buy some more Italian furniture? This is part of the, you know, statecraft approach, right, that you need to think about. But I can see that all of the tools are there available for them if they want to use them cynically, including the Fed, including that high interest rate to suck capital out and to say to everyone else, okay, so, you know, if we're going to put tariffs on you, which I'm sure America will, and we're going to have a strong dollar, and by the way, the two will feed each other because tariffs are the equivalent of a rate hike offshore for the offshore dollar, because you can't earn dollars anymore from trade. What are you going to do? You're going to devalue? You're going to let your currency go down? Fine, we're going to raise the tariff even higher. And eventually, at some point, that raises the cost of energy for them. Because, you know, while the dollar going up will push the cost of energy down, which Trump would like to a certain floor, I think, because that's good for the U.S. economy, good for U.S. consumers, it's going to start to get expensive for some countries, again, like China. If let's say oil's at 60, but the renminbi, purely hypothetically, no forecast. Let's say the renminbi goes from 7.5 to 10. Again, crazy, crazy forecast, but let's say it were to do that. Even if oil's gone down, you know, $15 a barrel, that still starts to get much, much more painful for them, particularly if they can't export to anybody on the back of it because, you know, other countries are going down with them or raising tariffs. So there's some combination of what we already, have in the toolkit in front of us, where I think we can pull those levers, create huge volatility in markets, which is what I'm warning my clients about, but at the same time, start to turn the ship of state around in the right direction. And Ira, if you're reassured that you think Bessent is the right kind of guy to be doing that as a Brit, an outsider, that's obviously strengthens my view that is what will happen. Certainly much more than if we'd had, you know, Mnuchin 2.0, who was going to be just saying tax cuts, yeah, and buy Italian furniture and gold toilets or whatever.
Well, if I may add, I don't know that he's going to be successful, but I know that the thought process is going to be far different than what we've been used to. And I think I'm at the beginning point of it, that's a good thing, because this is going to be take, as both of you really have alluded to, far more creative thought than what, you know, Janet Yellen may be academically bright, but I don't think she was practically bright. Well, meaning I shouldn't say bright, but successful. She was too concerned about other things, and that doesn't detract from her academically. But it, I didn't understand her always going to China and coming back with nothing. And all she did was
Magic mushrooms. She came back with magic mushrooms.
Right. And I wish I was there on that one, because I have some experience with cleaning out psilocybin mushrooms. Oh, wait a minute. I am of the
your FBI security clearance system.
I'm in the Hunter town. So, but for the life of me, all she did was say, you can't export. You can't flood the world with exports. You can't flood the world with exports. Well, what is that? I'm going to do just like the United States says. I'm going to do what I need to do to sustain myself in power. Because there's one thing that the Chinese cannot tolerate: high unemployment, and they cannot tolerate hunger. That's no Chinese. I don't care. Xi can. It's not going to happen, and he knows that. That's too. So they're going to do. So you can't go and tell them how they ought to run their existence. And this is, again, Michael, come back to you. This is just statecraft, and it's going to take a lot of great creativity to get through this period. Because as our talks about, energy is such a critical part of this, but there's so much more. It's energy. Energy needs, there's two things you can't get rid of: food and energy, because you have to feed your population and you have to provide energy to keep the population working. Without it, then we're having all kinds of different discussions. But those are first and foremost, and I don't care who you are, but when you expend, as you say, you're wasting so much capital doing nothing. And it goes back to the Trump years. I was totally critical of Trump's tax cuts of 2017, only because they weren't paid for. And that was on Gary Cohn and Mnuchin and that crowd. Had they paid for them? All for it. But they never were paid for, and they tried to get something. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the Kudlow, Arthur Laffer, we're going to grow our way out of it. You know, I've never been in that. I accept, I entertained it in the 80s, but for the life of me, as I said, no. You know, but that was from the defense group, who thought, well, we can spend as much as we want. We'll take on all that debt because we'll grow our way out of it. Okay, I get it, but we're not there. And now you're at a real situation where the cost of money becomes a serious factor.
Well, I'd like to build on those two points and ask two questions. One of them, what is money? And the second, I'll just mimic Michael, what is GDP for? And I will allow Michael to field the second part. But let me say something I learned from our mutual friend Nate Hagans a long time ago is that money is nothing more than a claim on energy. That's all it is. And if you think about, you know, some hypothetical situation in ancient Mesopotamia, and a guy has enough surplus wheat in his whatever they used as a barn back then, and he doesn't feel like doing some manual labor, and he goes out to some guy on the street and says, hey, you know, if you'll dig a ditch for me, I'll give you a bushel of wheat in exchange. And the guy says, yeah, sure, I can do that. And it works so well that eventually it gets really cumbersome to carry bushels of wheat around. And somebody says, hey, I got an idea. Let's make a coin. And this coin is redeemable for a certain number of bushels of wheat. Okay, well, that's what money is. And debt is nothing than a lien on future energy. And the big problem with renewable energy is that it doesn't have anywhere near the productivity, doesn't have 4.5 years of human labor in a barrel. And therefore, a world based on renewable energy, there's no creditor out there who's going to get paid back on his loan. And so credit contracts astronomically in a renewable world. And that's sadly something that the people that are behind all of these imaginary schemes, they don't live in that world, and so they can't imagine it. So that's my answer to what's money. Talk to us about GDP, Michael, would you?
Well, first of all, I love that comment, and I loved your earlier one too about measuring the man hours in a barrel of oil. It reminds me very much, being slightly technical, with Straffer's early work looking at commodities to produce commodities, and his analysis of the shortfalling of Marxism, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is the kind of serious, weighty thought process that can actually be summarized very simply, that needs to be on the desk of every single policymaker and think tank around the world. So from your mouth to God's ear, as they say. But in terms of what's GDP for, again, that can become normative really, 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 really easily. And we all have our vision of what we would like an idealized society to look like. And I think the key thing to do in this particular profession is, again, think, what will that answer be for the US?
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is that when you just described, money as a claim on energy, that is pretty much what the BRICS are trying to talk about in terms of the rough formation that they're putting forward as an alternative to the dollar, which is effectively increasingly a claim on financial assets rather mm-hmm. than energy. And they're trying to say it's a claim on commodities because that's what they're long. Obviously, China isn't. They're the exception. China is long at every kind of physical product made from those commodities which come from the global south en masse and then are sold to us. So China, effectively, even though the driver of it is ironically the exception to the rule within it. But the overall kind of BRICS attitude is, yes, so we are effectively talking about have some kind of monetary unit which is going to be an alternative to something which is a claim on a T-bill, which is a claim on, someone is creating an app that makes cats look like dogs in America, which is completely frivolous. So you can see what they're trying to do. And I think it ties together that ultimately, I think the US will conclude that GDP is for creating an economic structure, an economic statecraft structure and society, which is sustainable in the broadest sense of the term. I don't just mean energy. I mean also socioeconomic polarization and inequality, everyone having skin in the game, everyone having a chicken in the pot, et cetera, which allows them to have democracy, which is sustainable, and freedom from, from others and from overarching government at the same time, but which can therefore push back geopolitically against the long-run trend, which, if nothing else is done, will eventually argue in favor of a BRICS alternative, which says this is tied to energy, this is tied to physical production of a essential commodity, and yours isn't. It's tied to a frivolous financial asset. And we've still got a lot of room left in which that GDP tied to financial assets can be used to, as I said, turn the ship of state towards something which is more real and more realpolitik at the same time. But if it isn't, if it really is, GDP is for, kicking back, importing everything from around the world, swiping right on your phone, and just living in this virtual fantasy world while believing that the solar panels on your roof made in China are solving all your problems, we are in for a very, very rough ride. It might be an extremely smooth few years. We might be in an air-conditioned EV heading there with nice suspension, but we're going off of a cliff. Absolutely, we're going off of a cliff. So I hope GDP is for a fairer, in the broadest sense, more sustainable in the broadest sense model, which, if it works on the basis I'm hoping it works, can actually, to an extent, if not universally, be applied elsewhere with a lag. And I say that with the caveat, and I do believe, unfortunately, that when it comes to clashing ideological systems and political systems, there is an element of zero sum to this. There genuinely is. Mm-hmm. I don't think we come up with a world system, I'm not utopian, where everybody has everything they want, everyone has freedom, everyone has freedom of opportunity, everyone has an economic system where everyone gets everything they need. That can't happen. You're always going to have a system, unfortunately, where some are lower down in a hierarchy than others, and there will be hierarchies. But I think that we can have GDP for a better, more inclusive, more sustainable system, starting with the West, which can be expanded as a penumbra to others. And then it's up to others to see how they can adapt to that, and hopefully for the better rather than for the worse. And apologies if that's a long, rambling answer.
No, it's a good one, Michael. And the other better part that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is the rest of the planet that doesn't get to be part of this conversation and doesn't tune into a podcast. And that means not people, but the rest of the life on this planet, which we are, I mean, is in perilous condition at the moment because of human growth. Forget about climate change. I mean, I don't want to forget about it, but I don't want to get into it either here. But I mean, the population of the wild world, I mean, the fish, the animals, the reptiles, the insects, I'm not talking about extinctions. It has decreased 73% since 1970. Now, if that were a country, that would be like the grossest form of genocide that's ever occurred. Okay, that is the effect of the human project on the rest of the planet. Now, I'm not arguing here that we should all be tree huggers. What I'm arguing here is that human prosperity and even survival depends on a healthy ecosystem. And what we are doing to the planet right now is moving us in a direction that says very shortly, in fact, we're feeling it already, I believe, all of these grandiose ideas of economic statecraft and treasury bills and all these other things are going to be inconsequential if we have a less inhabitable planet. And so I don't want to solve that problem. I don't know that we're trying to solve any problem in this discussion, but I want to put it out there because it is a risk that markets, I think, take seriously, more seriously than renewable energy, by the way. There's a reason that I don't pretend to understand why markets have been shorting oil and gas for the last 5 or 6 years. Are they shorting growth? That's what I think, but that's speculative. So I'll end my discourse there.
Oh, that's great insight. I think we can go on for hours, but maybe we do one round table, go around the table for final thoughts, and also just to give our listeners and viewers some pointers and where they can find more information about your work. Michael?
Sure. Well, if people want to follow me, you can look for me on LinkedIn. You can look for me on X at the Michael Every. You'll find me there. And please do. I enjoy having conversations with people. You know, the simple argument that we've made here today is that the simple way we've been doing things for decades is going to have to change. Things are going to get a lot more complicated. And are there opportunities there? Yes. There's fantastic upside in all manner of ways from this particular process of chaos. But are there huge downsides? Absolutely. Equally though, if we weren't to do anything, if we were to be business as usual, and everyone say that, you know, we're, you know, three alta cacas just, you know, gabbering away, and actually there's no relevance to anything we're saying. Fair enough, you know, you can say that. Fair enough.
Yep.
Well, good luck, because if you think there's no downside to just reading, you know, your generic financial media headlines and worrying about is it going to be up 0.1 or down 0.1 or is the next move 25 basis points or 50 basis points in a vacuum, which is what most of the market does, you are really, really missing the bigger picture. And it's been a great privilege to be able to talk to Ira and Art today about this, because I think we need to have more serious conversations like this more often.
Great. Thanks, Michael. And Art?
Sure. And you can find me on X. You can find me on LinkedIn. I've got a website, which is absolutely 100% free and ad-free, and it's just artberman.com. More stuff there than anybody would care to sift through. But my sense is that we don't think, very few of us think systemically. We have a civilization that has progressively, and I don't mean in recent history, I mean for the last 5,000 years, has favored analytical specialization, which ultimately leads to reductionism. And I think that reductionism and ideology are like the two antichrists of human existence. And we desperately need people who are capable of seeing how things connect, because energy, economics, investment, military, they all connect. The environment connects. We're gonna assign different weights and different risks to those connections, but they all connect. And the idea, maybe the third antichrist is solutionism. We're gonna solve this. Well, okay, great, but by solving this, we usually create a bigger problem somewhere else. And you know, the question I always get is, well, that's great, Art. You know, we love hearing it, but what's the solution? Geez, you didn't listen to what I said. You know, if I knew the solution, you know, there are no solutions. That's the answer. And so what's needed is a more holistic approach to things. And that involves a lot more conversations. And for people who, you know, who want to get this thing done quickly, that's not very helpful. it's understandable. I'm sort of impatient at times myself. But the bigger picture and how it all fits together, the systemic, the holistic aspect is sorely missing at every level of our civilization, and certainly in the field of energy and economics.
Yes, great. Thanks, Art and Ira.
Well, I mean, this is certainly, again, yeah, you said we're just three old guys, or I'm an oldest guy, but we sit around and talk. Does it go anywhere? It really doesn't matter, because as Art talks about, there are worse outcomes and there are better outcomes. And then we'll go on to where they present us. So if they're worse outcomes, we have to deal with it. Now we're going to, that ain't going to work. And the ultimate is going to be too expensive. And what Michael talked about, I mean, we see China with their concept of shared prosperity. Now, that's not Chinese communism that Xi talks about. That's just a taxation system in whichever way it works, in which the wealthy are going to pay a lot more to support the bottom, and that type of shared prosperity. But all of it is based on, and I think Art really hits on it very well, you have to be dynamic. And the problem in the world that I have to overcome is the static nature, especially of the model builders.
Yeah,
models are so static. And they're great aggregators, but they're not, they don't really lead you to where you go. Yeah, they aggregate huge amounts of data, but the world is far more dynamic than that. You know, I look at, you know, the United States in after February of 2022, when Russia invades the Ukraine, the sanctions. Well, the Russians didn't sit there and just, oh, you're going to sanction me? I have no answer to it. They had a lot of answers to it. And none of them were anticipated by those, well, if we do this, we're going to, no, you're not. They already, and India was going to buy cheaper oil. You know, we're all, it's a kingdom of whores. And I don't mean that in a nefarious sense, because the world needs, you know, whores too, but it's a world of whores, and I'm going to do what's good for me. That's what you're doing. So when India buys cheaper Russian oil, refines it and sells it on the world market and puts the money in their pocket, okay, I understand that. But that's a dynamic response to what is a static policy. And we got to get away from those static policies. It's why I was never a fan of the Phillips curve, because it had no international component to it. And once 1989 comes and you unleash 2 billion more people into the global workforce, the Fed thinks that they're great because they were able to contain quote unquote inflation, but it was paid for on the back of especially developed world labor, especially US labor. because that's the way it worked. But yet the Phillips curve had no international function to it. It was based on basically 60s and 70s union models and the way that labor union power. So I think this conversation really bears fruit. Now, how you go and invest from here, that's, you have to be dynamic in the way that you invest. Because if you're waiting, yeah, you know, we can all sit in NVIDIA, but if you think that that plays out forever, good luck to you. I've lived through a lot of these things. The .com, you know, I watched people who really believed that this was the nirvana and it was going to be the end until Time Warner bought AOL, and all of a sudden you could put a valuation on these things and the perfect world was no longer perfect. And it's, you know, God bless you, keep making money. But I advise, and I think everybody here, be dynamic, because it's a shifting world. You know, we had the ESG group and they became enamored with wind and solar, but especially wind. And we know, you know, how that has worked out. And then other things get cast aside. Now uranium is a big play because everybody's focused on nuclear. And so they've bid it up to, again, a nirvana outcome. But the thing that I would advise, and I think everybody here would, be dynamic in the way that you view this, because, and if the problem solvers and the legislators would be dynamic, we'd have much better outcomes. We'd have much better outcomes. And look, you see what now the Biden administration, and again, not partisan, but they're spending all this last money because they don't want the incoming group to take it away from it. So they're just throwing money at projects that have not borne any fruit anyway, but they just don't want the next administration to be able to take it away. So these are the things that we need to rise above if we're going to be, otherwise, again, we can discuss money and GDP, and we can do money in terms of time and energy, because that's what they're a store of. But if you, in my world, if money stops being a dependable store of value and I can't call that energy into my use because what I've stored up in anticipation of it just won't buy as much, I'm not a happy camper. And now I got to go. So it bears a lot of responsibility, and that requires exactly what has been brought here today. And not by me, but a much more dynamic attitude, because these are shifting sands. And I'll leave you with this. There's a headline out tonight. Now, it hasn't been confirmed, but I was waiting for this. But Giuliani, who just tossed out Assad, it's amazing how now everybody's concerned about Assad. These bastards have destroyed Syria. You know, let's go back to 1982 when the old man killed 25, 30, 40,000 people in Hama for having the audacity to rise up. And literally, you don't hear a word. Now all of a sudden you hear a lot about it. But Giuliani made an interesting comment. He wants in on the Abraham Accords. Mm-hmm. If he goes that route, that's a dynamic function that brings a lot of other things into play, because the Saudis get right in line and all of a sudden the Iranians are totally isolated. Now, it may be a dangerous Iran, but I'm not sure they're going to lick some wounds here and go, hey, you know, we don't have a great leg up to stand here. But these are things that are constantly, and it will have a huge thing for energy, because now all of a sudden Iraq becomes a far different place on that Western flank that is not a Shiite organized, but now part of the Sunni. The world, it changes so quickly, and this is what we're involved in. So you got to change with it with good policy. And again, as Art has talked about, this is all about the energy. And those pipelines will be coming, you know, now, of course, we haven't, then Turkey, but again, and then we're back to Crimea and the Dardanelles, because that's going to be a whole lot of energy besides pipeline energy coming through. I mean, there's so much going on. And that's, so don't get caught and be stayed in your thinking, as the media, as especially the mainstream media, has come under a lot of criticism, and rightfully so, because they just go talk to the, you know, the most available person who's selling something, selling an idea. And it, again, it's past its static be much more dynamic. And I think Michael and I really lay it out. You may not like where it goes, but too bad. Too bad.
Yeah, awesome, insightful discussion, great analysis. Thank you so much, Michael, Art, and Ira. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you all.
This has been great. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.